This is tape three. When the last tape ended, we were talking about the graduate seminars in American Thought and Language.
So we had we began those. When did that happen? Remember when Jocelyn became chair?
88, 89.
Yeah. Must have been. No, it must have been before that. Must have been 87.
87, okay.
Because 88, I've got another program that I got into then. Oh, yeah. And now, just a side note on that transition. There was terrifically, Henry had very hard feelings about all this. And ultimately, he said he would only communicate with Jocelyn in writing. So, and I was around, so I was kind of de facto. I was the go-between. Henry would talk to me. Henry just left.
Would talk with you and not Jocelyn.
Yeah. Oh. Henry just, you know, just left that summer. And Jocelyn didn't start until August or something, and I was there. I don't know why I was there. Well, I know why I was there, because I was setting up the program.
Okay.
For the developmental program for the fall.
That would have been 87?
Yeah,
summer of 87. Okay.
And so I was around, you know. But anyway, so it was a very successful seminar, and the whole year just went swimmingly, you know. I directed that, and I taught a developmental course, which took me all the way back. I was glad to have the seminar, frankly, because it has, you know, it's some very good ideas and the things that worked. And you know, frankly, the developmental had been kind of a stepchild, and it had not been much of a program. You know, it was really in disarray. So it was an opportunity with the influx of graduate students and a new system to kind of bring some coherence and substance to it. And I think we did. And that was, so I did that, and let's see, that's 87. I did that 4 years, 5 years, 4 years, 5 years, and I was good. I was going to take a sabbatical. Well, I was going to take a sabbatical. That's right. I was going to take a sabbatical until Jocelyn asked me to do the developmental thing. I said, okay. Well, so then I was going to take a sabbatical. And then Jocelyn nominated me for associate dean. And I said, okay, I'd do that. I'd allow her to nominate me. But I wasn't sure what I was going to do this. So I went through the interview process, which is all conducted by the college council, and good interviews, you know, it was fine. And then he called me up. He called me in and talked to me. And, you know, he's an interesting guy. He had some interesting questions. He wanted to know... what I would say if people thought this was kind of a payoff to ATL for behaving. I said, well, I hope they saw it that way. I said, because ATL is about time. ATL was, you know, a central part of the college. And he was, well, you know, but the ATL might not have been terribly... You know, was not admired entirely in the whole college. You know, what could I bring to it? And I said, well, I had a standing in the department, in the college as well. You know, I was the first one from the department elected to the graduate council, and we have no graduate program. And that, you know, that shattered ice there. I mean, you know how it is. You know, mm-hmm. You don't have a graduate program. You can't even be on the graduate council, let alone be on the university graduate council, coming from a department that doesn't have a graduate program. So that was unprecedented, and he recognized that. And so he asked me to come on for the 3 years, which I did, And a very, in retrospect, that was a very good, that was a very good appointment for me. It was just the right time. I'd finished all my books. And I was looking for a new research topic, but I didn't have one, you know. And there was, you know, that was, you know, a new dean, new chance, maybe. And I really thought I could do a good service for ATL, as well as the college, you know, there. And it really turned out that way. I think John Eadie made his appointments on the basis of individuals' qualities, not on their politics or their, I mean, they're not, by politics I don't mean left or right, I mean who they're associated with. So it wasn't an ATL appointment, you know, as like he had to have somebody from ATL or he had to have somebody from, it wasn't that. All of his appointments, if you look at them, were people that he felt had qualities that would help him in his administration. Pat McConaughey was certainly that way. And Dan, so was Pat Paulson, the one who replaced me. But it was also true of the chairs. The only awkward position he got into was Henry over in history department. But Doug Nover was certainly an inspired selection. I didn't think Doug would take it. And when he said he was going to ask him, I said, "You, boy, more power to you. You know, this, he is exactly the right guy to get." But that was all John's idea. This mm-hmm. was not mine. I mean, I mentioned that because he had a very good sense of who was good, would be good in that job. But going into the dean's office did give me an opportunity to change some views about ATL. I mean, I know, I think the first meeting I went to with, who was the admissions guy? Bill Turner. Talking about enrollment projections. He said, "Well, you know, you just add a few sections of ATL." I said, "Wait a minute. You know what that means?" You know, and I came to appreciate the difficulty of projecting how many students you're going to have there, you know, and all that. But I said, "That's not the way you look at it, you know." And we'd had to, you know, there was a meeting when Jocelyn and Milt and I were under excruciating pressure from my good friend Jim Hamilton, nonetheless, you know, but from the provost's office, to increase class size. And we, you know, we were sitting there kind of imaginatively writing out our letters of resignation. And the provost's office backed out on that one. Well, it was the same, it never was that dramatic again. But, you know, and I could then be in places where comments like that would be made or some, or where there was an opportunity to showcase not just the college but the ATL, mm-hmm. you know, and what they're doing and the important role they were playing. And, you know, so it gave me, it wasn't a bully pulpit, but it was a little, you know, a little lectern, you know, than I had. And I enjoyed that. And I enjoyed, you know, I worked with the reason that we have an audit is because I pushed for that. I mean, when I brought that up about the first year I was in the dean's office. Mm-hmm. Oh, it can't be done.
The financial audit?
No.
Oh.
Course audit.
Oh, okay.
Transcript audit. And when I brought that up, they said, "This can't be done." And it took 4 years until they said, "Oh, yeah, well, here's how we can do it." And then I'm not sure they did it right, you know. But there was nobody. I mean, I was a lone voice. And you can ask, what's her name, the one that replaced King Lou? in the registrar's office. She was acting registrar forever. I don't know if she was made full registrar or not.
I don't know.
But at any rate, they, you know, I we had many, many meetings about that where I sat down and say, now here's, you gotta have a, so the student has a what if capability. They can look at their own transcript and the curriculum and the course choices and all of that, you know. And the online, you know, the registration online, that I didn't have anything to do with creating.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but then putting that together, and that was part of the problem, putting that together with student access to their own records.
The degree navigator.
The degree navigator. Uh-huh. All of that. That was one of the things I was able to push until it happened.
Yeah, well, I know students find that tremendously useful now.
Yeah, well, that was, God, it was so, well, I mean, it seems so self-evident to me, you know. I mean, of course, I hadn't thought about it, and then I went to one of these associate dean's meetings in the Big Ten, you know, I don't know where it was, Penn State, I think, it was Penn State the first year that they were in the Big Ten, and there was every year there was a meeting of associate deans in the Big Ten schools, and they, Ohio State was doing something then on degree audit, and they had their own program they were trying to build up, but then others started talking about it and how they were, you know, moving toward doing something like that. I brought that back, and geez, she thought that I'd come from the moon. You can't do that. And then it did become a terrible problem because of the way the registration system was set up. You know, they built their own here instead of buying a package,
mm-hmm.
and then trying to get that to interface with you know, the degree audit stuff was. That's where the problem was. That's why it couldn't be done.
Mm-hmm. Well, because the software was proprietary rather than,
well, and they, you know, and they couldn't get them to interface either.
I see.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, but at any rate, that was, so there were several things in the, you know, that it gave me an opportunity. Being in administration that way gave me an opportunity. I was on the task force to with John Hudzik to redo our whole international, our study abroad program, you know, and I nominated him to be dean. Actually, I nominated to the dean to nominate him to be dean of international programs, and he is now,
mm-hmm.
and a good one, I think.
And, you know, seems so the area of push,
yes,
or yeah. Emphasis, yeah.
Well, it was that task force report, mm-hmm. that said, you know, laid out a goal of 40%. Are going to have an overseas studies experience. We'd like it to be 100. And of course, he had McPherson behind it too, which mm-hmm. made a big difference.
Besides your own service overseas in Germany, and then your interest in foreign service initially. Did you have Fulbright or anything? Were you?
No, I was.
Were you studied overseas or?
Yes, I went overseas, but that was a special arrangement with Al Hollingsworth, who was dean of College of Arts and Letters. He was a. I think he had been doing some research on the Taiping Revolution or something of that sort. And he was studying Chinese, spoke Chinese, developed a relationship with, was eager in developing relationships with Chinese universities, had developed a relationship with Xibei Dashui, Northwest University, one of the key universities. This was in Xi'an in China. And had sent over there a graduate student in 1983-84, and had brought to this country a young faculty member, all under college money. The following year, he sent Jim McClintock over there. And the third year, he called me and asked me if I wanted to go. So I could afford to. I mean, my family was here, and my salary continued here. And then I went there, and the Chinese paid me a lot more than the Chinese got, but not a lot of money. but enough so I could live there, you know. And I spent 1 year teaching English majors in Northwest University, American and English literature. English literature was a stretch because I had never taken a course in it. But then, you know, this, it was really language training.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But it was a most, most interesting time. That's a Chinese curse, did you know that?
No.
May you live in interesting times?
Yes, right.
Well, it was interesting. I was never bored in China. Mm-hmm. And you have not enough tape for me to tell you all the things that happened there. But I was the lead faculty member there from a major university. There was another guy from Oregon State there with his wife. There was there were two graduate students from MSU there. And there was a couple of other foreigners there, one from Canada, one retired woman from the United States. And the Chinese just made me first of all, they made me 50. I wasn't 50 yet. But that's the cutoff for a senior status. So my age was 50 when I got there. I was 48 or something. So I was sort of the contact one, the one responsible for whatever all these Americans and foreign nationals did, which got to be interesting at times.
Mm-hmm. So you were the head colonel, huh?
Yeah, I was. But we traveled, and my wife came over, Nadine came over during their Chinese New Year, which was in the spring, and we spent 5 weeks, the two of us, traveling around in China. I met her in Hong Kong, and we went to Guangzhou, and Guilin, Kunming, and then down in a beautiful area of southwestern China, in Shishuang Bana, just idyllic. And then back to Kunming, Shanghai, Xi'an for some time, then out to Beijing. So we got around.
How was the reception of the people toward Americans?
Well, it was very pleasant. I at no time did I feel threatened in China at all. You had to get used to certain things, you know, because they're so very curious. And quite literally now, I mean this literally, you could be standing there at a shop, you know, or a grocery store or something, and realize that there's a nose in your ear, you know. I mean, they get right up in next to you. And, you know, I was taller than most Chinese, so they were just crowded around, you know. And when there are billions of people, I suppose they don't have the same sense of space that Americans do. So you had to become accustomed to that. The official reception and official treatment in the university was wonderful. There were a lot of difficulties, but they tried very much to overcome them and to be helpful, and there was never any hostilities. There were some anxieties, you know. I passed a kidney stone there, and that was not something you want to do. I had to ride to the hospital over a cobblestone street on a bicycle while I was passing this damn stone.
Oh, no.
They were very protective, did not want us to have bicycles. Took a long time for us to persuade them to allow us to buy bicycles. Because that, you know, I mean, I realized how autonomous we are in this country. You know, you just go out and get in your car and you go wherever the hell you want. Well, they didn't quite like us doing that. They they weren't afraid that we would see something we shouldn't see, in the sense of some secret, but that maybe we'd see something that they didn't want us to see in terms of the conditions.
That's like him.
Or that we might be embarrassed in some way. And if this was true in the classroom, students were very reluctant to ask me questions. And I, coming from an American university, you know, that took a while to get accustomed to, and I figured out the reason they were reluctant was that if they asked me a question and I didn't know the answer, I would lose face, and they would be the cause of me losing face.
I see.
So it would be an embarrassment to them.
See? In a sense, I see.
There was a lot of this indirection in China. Mm-hmm. But the students were just great. You know, I'm sure I caused problems. I'm sure there's no question in my mind that Tiananmen Square is a consequence of opening to the West and having all these foreign experts in the country, because you know, I had students who was a party cadre, you know, in the class. You know, when we were reading John Stuart Mill's essay on liberty, in which he makes some very unhappy comments about Chinese culture, one. But he also talked about a liberal education, you know, and China is a very small portion of the people get to college, 3% or something like that. And they go to a designed program, a designed curriculum, kind of like the first year of ATL when I got here. And they have their classroom, and the teachers come into their classroom. They maintain the classroom. They all have the same curriculum, and they go right through this curriculum. There are no electives. So here we are talking about choices. And this guy says, I want to take, you know, a course in tourism so I can be a guide, you know. Why can't I do that? I said, I don't know why you can't do it. And I gave a lecture to the campus community on the credit system and how that works. Because there was a growing interest in it. Their first reaction to a credit system, and which I would argue implies choice, because you accumulate, as Thorsten Veblen said, a certain body of staple credits, and that's how you graduate. Mm-hmm. What the composition of that body is an American university has a great deal of latitude. Well, all they did was just assign credit hours to them. Same curriculum, mm-hmm. same sequencing, no choice. Next step was going to be, now you may take one elective course, or two, or three, or. Right? It's hard for them to change that system. But that idea of, you know, you just inherently, you talk about American literature and American ideas and American history, and you're talking about, you know, democratic reforms and democratic movements and personal liberties, and you know, those always have been conspiracies, you know.
In looking back on your career at Michigan State, you mentioned that you and your wife were going to give it 3 years.
Yeah.
Did you have other offers, or was there any other point that you thought about leaving? Or
yeah, yeah, there were. Did I have any other offers? No. Hmm. None of them. None of the interviews came to that. I went to Boston in 1970 at Christmas to the AHA. 3 years after I had graduated from Minnesota. And I was there for the advisory council. We didn't have any positions, but we might get some positions. So I was there to, I was going down the elevator and I heard these guys talking about the pit. And they had, you know, AHA says, so it might be a restaurant. So Nadine and I, we went down, and I went into the ballroom down there. And I had been to the AHA in Chicago, I think it was. I don't remember where it was when I was looking for a job. And I went into a ballroom like that, and there were 3x5 cards just all over the wall, you know, all around the damn room with the jobs. And I went in there, there was nothing. There was nothing on the walls.
In 3-year difference.
And there were 3-ring notebooks with Venus. I said, whoa, you know, I'm glad I got out what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the New York Times had an article about it. What had happened in the historical profession. You know, it had just clamped down at that point. So I didn't really think much then, you know, about applying for another academic job. I did think about, you know, other jobs, but you know, it was, MSU kept turning out to be a pretty good place to be. A certain inertia takes over, and we were there when the kids, the circumstances were fine. Nadine got a job a few years later, but once the kids were gone, then, I went to Northern Iowa to interview for a chair job there. And they were intimidated. They really were looking at somebody who had been in the state system, you know. They were a little worried that I'd come in with some research agenda demands for him, you know, and things of that sort. It was not a good fit. It was a nice enough place. I got to meet relatives I hadn't seen in years. My dad was born in Waverly, and my grandparents are buried there, so, which is just a few miles away. And then, after I had been in the dean's office for 3 years, it was a 3-year gig. That was the way he put it. That's fine. And near the end of the third year. Metropolitan State in St. Paul was looking for a dean. And the place was right. You know, all our kids are there. So I had Jocelyn nominate me. And I was a finalist there. But they were... It was not a good fit there either. I mean, I came in with a vocabulary that was giving them some trouble. It's not a community college, but it relied very heavily on local resources for staffing, business people, like a community college.
Mm-hmm. You know,
but it's a university.
Mm-hmm.
And also, they were hiring a lot of people from graduate students from Minnesota. There to teach some introductory courses. And they had a lot of long-term temporaries. And I said, here it is, folks.
Mm-hmm.
This is what your trouble is and what you're in for. And they'd already had one suit of somebody trying to get a permanent job.
Mm-hmm.
They're talking about expanding, getting tenure stream jobs. And I was saying, okay, how are you going to do this? You know, here's in the what the problem would be if you want to create now a core of permanent faculty on the basis of a national search. You have a whole pool of people who have been here who have reasonable expectations that they can compete well for those jobs. And if you don't hire, you've got trouble. If you hire, you may still have trouble, you know. But
that was something you were experienced.
Yes, I had a lot of experience with that. You know, and it was no matter what they decided, it was going to cause, it was going to be turmoil, and it was going to be a lot of tension. And so they'd better gear up for it. And then after I got home, and thought about it, said no. Been there, done that. And so when they called, they wanted me to come back and talk to the provost and the president. And we had, this was the assistant provost I was talking to. We had a conversation. I said, it doesn't feel right. I said, I don't think you'd be happy with me. And I don't think you'd be happy in that situation. You know? And so that was that. But I told the dean, you know, that I was going there. So he, without knowing, he talked to the chairs and asked them if, told them that he wanted to reappoint me. And that he knew it was a 3-year job, but he wanted me to stay there. And the chairs all unanimously agreed that fine, that's okay with us. So then I stayed on, and that's why I wound up. Then when I knew he was going to resign, and I told him, no, I went off the first of the year. Because he was going to be off in June, going to leave in June. Mm-hmm. I said, I want to serve until 6 months before you're off. I do not want to be in a position where I would have to work in a transition. That's all. And he was very good about that. And he agreed, you know, to let me resign.